Tuesday, June 6, 1944. My dearest Kitty, this is D-Day, the BBC announced at 12. This is the day. The invasion has begun. This morning at 8, the British reported heavy bombing of Calais, Boulogne, Le Havre, and Cherbourg, as well as Pas-de-Calais, as usual. Further, as a precautionary measure for those in the occupied territories, everyone living within a zone of 20 miles from the coast was warned to prepare for bombardments. Where possible, the British will drop pamphlets an hour ahead of time. According to the German news, British paratroopers have landed on the coast of France. British landing craft are engaged in combat with German naval units, according to the BBC. Conclusion reached by the annex while breakfasting at 9. This is a trial landing, like the one 2 years ago in Dieppe. BBC broadcast in German, Dutch, French, and other languages at 10. The invasion has begun, so this is the real invasion. BBC broadcast in German at 11. Speech by Supreme Commander General Dwight Eisenhower. BBC broadcast in English. This is D-Day, General Eisenhower said to the French people. Stiff fighting will come now, but after this, the victory. The year 1944 is the year of complete victory. Good luck. BBC broadcast in English at 1. 11,000 planes are shuttling back and forth or standing by to land troops and bomb behind enemy lines. 4,000 landing craft and small boats are continually arriving in the area between Cherbourg and Le Havre. English and American troops are already engaged in heavy combat. Speeches by Gerbrandy, the Prime Minister of Belgium, King Haakon of Norway, de Gaulle of France, the King of England, and last but not least, Churchill. A huge commotion in the annex. Is this really the beginning of the long-awaited liberation? The liberation we've all talked so much about, which still seems too good, too much of a fairy tale ever to come true? Will this year, 1944, bring us victory? We don't know yet, but where there's hope, there's life. It fills us with fresh courage and makes us strong again. We'll need to be brave to endure the many fears and hardships and the suffering yet to come. It's now a matter of remaining calm and steadfast, of gritting our teeth and keeping a stiff upper lip. France, Russia, Italy, and even Germany can cry out in agony, but we don't yet have that right. Oh, Kitty, the best part about the invasion is that I have the feeling that friends are on the way. Those terrible Germans have oppressed and threatened us for so long that the thought of friends and salvation means everything to us. Now it's not just the Jews, but Holland and all of occupied Europe. Maybe, Margot says, I can even go back to school in September or October. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. I'll keep you informed of the latest news. This morning and last night, dummies made of straw and rubber were dropped from the air behind German lines, and they exploded the minute they hit the ground. Many paratroopers, their faces blackened so they couldn't be seen in the dark, landed as well. The French coast was bombarded with 5,500 tons of bombs during the night, and then, at 6 in the morning, the first landing craft came ashore. Today, there were 20,000 airplanes in action. The German coastal batteries were destroyed even before the landing. A small bridgehead has already been formed. Everything's going well despite the bad weather. The army and the people are one will and one hope. Friday, June 9th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, great news of the invasion. The Allies have taken Bayeux, a village on the coast of France, and are now fighting for Caen. They're clearly intending to cut off the peninsula where Cherbourg is located. Every evening, the war correspondents report on the difficulties, the courage, and the fighting spirit of the army. To get their stories, they pull off the most amazing feats. A few of the wounded who are already back in England also spoke on the radio. Despite the miserable weather, the planes are flying diligently back and forth. We heard over the BBC that Churchill wanted to land along with the troops on D-Day, but Eisenhower and the other generals managed to talk him out of it. Just imagine, so much courage for such an old man. He must be at least 70. The excitement here has died down somewhat. Still, we're all hoping that the war will finally be over by the end of the year. It's about time. Mrs. Van Dan's constant griping is unbearable. Now that she can no longer drive us crazy with the invasion, she moans and groans all day about the bad weather. If only we could plunk her down in the loft in a bucket of cold water. Everyone in the annex except Mr. Van Dan and Peter has read The Hungarian Rhapsody Trilogy, a biography of the composer, piano virtuoso, and child prodigy Franz Liszt. It's very interesting, though in my opinion, there's a bit too much emphasis on women. Liszt was not only the greatest and most famous pianist of his time, he was also the biggest womanizer, even at the age of 70. He had an affair with Countess Marie Daigou, Princess Caroline von Wittgenstein, the dancer Lola Montez, the pianist Agnes Kingworth, the pianist Sophie Menter, the Circassian Princess Olga Yanina, Baroness Olga Meyendorf, actress Lilla What's-Her-Name, etc., etc., and there's no end to it. Those parts of the book dealing with music and the other arts are much more interesting. Some of the people mentioned are Schumann, Clara Wieck, Hector Berlioz, Johannes Brahms, Beethoven, Joachim, Richard Wagner, Hans von Bülow, Anton Rubinstein, Frederick Chopin, Victor Hugo, Honoré de Balzac, Hiller, Hummel, Czerny, Rossini, Cherubini, Paganini, Mendelssohn, etc., etc. Liszt appears to have been a decent man, very generous and modest, though exceptionally vain. He helped others, put art above all else, was extremely fond of cognac and women, couldn't bear the sight of tears, was a gentleman, couldn't refuse anyone a favor, wasn't interested in money, and cared about religious freedom and the world. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, June 13th, 1944. Dearest Kit, another birthday has gone by, so I'm now 15. I received quite a few gifts. Springer's 5-volume art history book, a set of underwear, 2 belts, a handkerchief, 2 jars of yogurt, a jar of jam, 2 honey cookies, small, a botany book from father and mother, a gold bracelet from Margot, a sticker album from the Van Dans, biomalt and sweet peas from Dussel, candy from Meep, candy and notebooks from Bep, and the high point, the book Maria Teresa and 3 slices of full cream cheese from Mr. Kugler. Peter gave me a lovely bouquet of peonies. The poor boy had put a lot of effort into finding a present, but nothing quite worked out. The invasion is still going splendidly, in spite of the miserable weather. Pouring rains, gale winds, and high seas. Yesterday, Churchill, Smoots, Eisenhower, and Arnold visited the French villages that the British have captured and liberated. Churchill was on a torpedo boat that shelled the coast. Like many men, he doesn't seem to know what fear is. An enviable trait. From our position here in Fort Annex, it's difficult to gauge the mood of the Dutch. No doubt many people are glad the idle British have finally rolled up their sleeves and gotten down to work. Those who keep claiming they don't want to be occupied by the British don't realize how unfair they're being. Their line of reasoning boils down to this. England must fight, struggle, and sacrifice its sons to liberate Holland and the other occupied countries. After that, the British shouldn't remain in Holland. They should offer their most abject apologies to all the occupied countries, restore the Dutch East Indies to its rightful owner, and then return, weakened and impoverished, to England. What a bunch of idiots. And yet, as I've already said, many Dutch people can be counted among their ranks. What would have become of Holland and its neighbors if England had signed a peace treaty with Germany, as it's had ample opportunity to do? Holland would have become German, and that would have been the end of that. All those Dutch people who still look down on the British, scoff at England and its government of aging lords, call the English cowards yet hate the Germans, should be given a good shaking, the way you'd plump up a pillow. Maybe that would straighten out their jumbled brains. Wishes, thoughts, accusations, and reproaches are swirling around in my head. I'm not really as conceited as many people think. I know my various faults and shortcomings better than anyone else, but there's one difference. I also know that I want to change, will change, and already have changed greatly. Why is it, I often ask myself, that everyone still thinks I'm so pushy and such a know-it-all? Am I really so arrogant? Am I the one who's so arrogant, or are they? It sounds crazy, I know. but I'm not going to cross out that last sentence because it's not as crazy as it seems. Mrs. Van Dan and Dussel, my two chief accusers, are known to be totally unintelligent and, not to put too fine a point on it, just plain stupid. Stupid people usually can't bear it when others do something better than they do. The best examples of this are those two dummies, Mrs. Van Dan and Dussel. Mrs. Van D thinks I'm stupid because I don't suffer so much from this ailment as she does. She thinks I'm pushy because she's even pushier. She thinks my dresses are too short because hers are even shorter, and she thinks I'm such a know-it-all because she talks twice as much as I do about topics she knows nothing about. The same goes for Dussel. But one of my favorite sayings is, where there's smoke, there's fire, and I readily admit I'm a know-it-all. What's so difficult about my personality is that I scold and curse myself much more than anyone else does. If Mother adds her advice, the pile of sermons becomes so thick that I despair of ever getting through them. Then I talk back and start contradicting everyone until the old familiar Anne refrain inevitably crops up again. No one understands me! This phrase is part of me, and as unlikely as it may seem, there's a kernel of truth in it. Sometimes I'm so deeply buried under self-reproaches that I long for a word of comfort to help me dig myself out again. If only I had someone who took my feelings seriously. Alas, I haven't yet found that person, so the search must go on. I know you're wondering about Peter, aren't you, Kit? It's true, Peter loves me. Not as a girlfriend, but as a friend. His affection grows day by day, but some mysterious force is holding us back, and I don't know what it is. Sometimes I think my terrible longing for him was over-exaggerated. But that's not true, because if I'm unable to go to his room for a day or two, I long for him as desperately as I ever did. Peter is kind and good, and yet I can't deny that he's disappointed me in many ways. I especially don't care for his dislike of religion, his talk of food, and various things of that nature. Still, I'm firmly convinced that we'll stick to our agreement never to quarrel. Peter is peace-loving, tolerant, and extremely easygoing. He lets me say a lot of things to him that he'd never accept from his mother. He's making a determined effort to remove the blots from his copybook and keep his affairs in order. Yet why does he hide his innermost self and never allow me access? Of course, he's much more closed than I am, but I know from experience, even though I'm constantly being accused of knowing all there is to know in theory but not in practice, that in time, even the most uncommunicative types will long as much, or even more, for someone to confide in. Peter and I have both spent our contemplative years in the annex. We often discuss the future, the past, and the present, but as I've already told you, I miss the real thing, and yet I know it exists. Is it because I haven't been outdoors for so long that I've become so smitten with nature? I remember a time when a magnificent blue sky, chirping birds, moonlight, and budding blossoms wouldn't have captivated me. Things have changed since I came here. One night during the Pentecost holiday, for instance, when it was so hot, I struggled to keep my eyes open until 11:30 so I could get a good look at the moon, all on my own for once. Alas, my sacrifice was in vain, since there was too much glare and I couldn't risk opening a window. Another time, several months ago, I happened to be upstairs one night when the window was open. I didn't go back down until it had to be closed again. The dark, rainy evening, the wind, the racing clouds, had me spellbound. It was the first time in a year and a half that I'd seen the night face to face. After that evening, my longing to see it again was even greater than my fear of burglars, a dark, rat-infested house, or police raids. I went downstairs all by myself and looked out the windows in the kitchen and private office. Many people think nature is beautiful. Many people sleep from time to time under the starry sky, and many people in hospitals and prisons long for the day when they'll be free to enjoy what nature has to offer. But few are as isolated and cut off as we are from the joys of nature, which can be shared by rich and poor alike. It's not just my imagination. Looking at the sky, the clouds, the moon, and the stars really does make me feel calm and hopeful. It's much better medicine than valerian or bromide. Nature makes me feel humble and ready to face every blow with courage. As luck would have it, I'm only able, except for a few rare occasions, to view nature through dusty curtains tacked over dirt-caked windows. It takes the pleasure out of looking. Nature is the one thing for which there is no substitute. One of the many questions that have often bothered me is why women have been, and still are, thought to be so inferior to men. It's easy to say it's unfair, but that's not enough for me. I'd really like to know the reason for this great injustice. Men presumably dominated women from the very beginning because of their greater physical strength. It's men who earn a living, beget children, and do as they please. Until recently, women silently went along with this, which was stupid, since the longer it's kept up, the more deeply entrenched it becomes. Fortunately, education, work, and progress have opened women's eyes. In many countries, they've been granted equal rights. Many people, mainly women, but also men, now realize how wrong it was to tolerate this state of affairs for so long. Modern women want the right to be completely independent. But that's not all. Women should be respected as well. Generally speaking, men are held in great esteem in all parts of the world. So why shouldn't women have their share? Soldiers and war heroes are honored and commemorated. Explorers are granted immortal fame. Martyrs are revered. But how many people look upon women, too, as soldiers? In the book, Men Against Death, I was greatly struck by the fact that in childbirth alone, women commonly suffer more pain, illness, and misery than any war hero ever does. And what's her reward for enduring all that pain? She gets pushed aside when she's disfigured by birth. Her children soon leave. Her beauty is gone. Women who struggle and suffer pain to ensure the continuation of the human race make much tougher and more courageous soldiers than all those big-mouthed, freedom-fighting heroes put together. I don't mean to imply that women should stop having children. On the contrary, nature intended them to, and that's the way it should be. What I condemn are our system of values and the men who don't acknowledge how great, difficult, but ultimately beautiful women's share in society is. I agree completely with Paul de Kriff, the author of this book, when he says that men must learn that birth is no longer thought of as inevitable and unavoidable in those parts of the world we consider civilized. It's easy for men to talk. They don't and never will have to bear the woes that women do. I believe that in the course of the next century, the notion that it's a woman's duty to have children will change and make way for the respect and admiration of all women who bear their burdens without complaint or a lot of pompous words. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, June 16th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, new problems. Mrs. Van D is at her wit's end. She's talking about getting shot, being thrown in prison, being hanged, and suicide. She's jealous that Peter confides in me and not in her, offended that Dussel doesn't respond sufficiently to her flirtations, and afraid her husband's going to squander all the fur coat money on tobacco. She quarrels, curses, cries, feels sorry for herself, laughs, and starts all over again. What on earth can you do with such a silly, sniveling specimen of humanity? Nobody takes her seriously. She has no strength of character. She complains to one and all, and you should see how she walks around. Von hinten Lyceum, von vorne Museum. Even worse, Peter's becoming insolent, Mr. Van Dan irritable, and Mother cynical. Yes, everyone's in quite a state. There's only one rule you need to remember. Laugh at everything and forget everybody else. It sounds egotistical, but it's actually the only cure for those suffering from self-pity. Mr. Kugler's supposed to spend 4 weeks in Alkmaar on a work detail. He's trying to get out of it with a doctor's certificate and a letter from Opecta. Mr. Kleiman's hoping his stomach will be operated on soon. Starting at 11 last night, all private phones were cut off. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, June 23rd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, nothing special going on here. The British have begun their all-out attack on Cherbourg. According to Pym and Mr. Van Dan, we're sure to be liberated before October 10th. The Russians are taking part in the campaign. Yesterday they started their offensive near Vitebsk, exactly 3 years to the day that the Germans invaded Russia. Bep's spirits have sunk lower than ever. We're nearly out of potatoes. From now on, we're going to count them out for each person. Then everyone can do what they want with them. Starting Monday, Meep's taking a week of vacation. Mr. Kleiman's doctors haven't found anything on the x-rays. He's torn between having an operation and letting matters take their course. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, June 27th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, the mood has changed. Everything's going enormously well. Cherbourg, Vitebsk, and Zhlobin fell today. They're sure to have captured lots of men and equipment. 5 German generals were killed near Cherbourg and 2 taken captive. Now that they've got a harbor, the British can bring whatever they want on shore. The whole Cotentin Peninsula has been captured just 3 weeks after the invasion. What a feat! In the 3 weeks since D-Day, there hasn't been a day without rain and storms, neither here nor in France. But this bad luck hasn't kept the British and the Americans from displaying their might. And how? Of course, the Germans have launched their wonder weapon. But a little firecracker like that won't hardly make a dent, except maybe minor damage in England and screaming headlines in the Kraut newspapers. Anyway, when they realize in Krautland that the Bolsheviks really are getting closer, they'll be shaking in their boots. All German women who aren't working for the military are being evacuated, together with their children, from the coastal regions to the provinces of Groningen, Friesland, and Gelderland. Mussert has announced that if the invasion reaches Holland, he'll enlist. Is that fat pig planning to fight? He could have done that in Russia long before now. Finland turned down a peace offer some time ago, and now the negotiations have been broken off again. Those numbskulls, they'll be sorry. How far do you think we'll be on July 27th? Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, June 30th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, bad weather from 1 at a stretch to the 30 June. Don't I say that well? Oh, yes, I already know a little English. Just to prove it, I'm reading An Ideal Husband with the help of a dictionary. War's going wonderfully. Bobruisk, Mogilev, and Orsha have fallen. Lots of prisoners. Everything's all right here. Spirits are improving. Our super optimists are triumphant. The Van Dans are doing disappearing acts with the sugar. Beps changed her hair, and Meep has a week off. That's the latest news. I've been having really ghastly root canal work done on one of my front teeth. It's been terribly painful. It was so bad, Dussel thought I was going to faint, and I nearly did. Mrs. Van D promptly got a toothache as well. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. We've heard from Basel that Berndt played the part of the innkeeper in Mina von Barnhelm. He has artistic leanings, says Mother. Thursday, July 6th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, my blood runs cold when Peter talks about becoming a criminal or a speculator. Of course, he's joking, but I still have the feeling he's afraid of his own weakness. Margot and Peter are always saying to me, if I had your spunk and your strength, if I had your drive and unflagging energy, I could... Is it really such an admirable trait not to let myself be influenced by others? Am I right in following my own conscience? To be honest, I can't imagine how anyone could say, I'm weak, and then stay that way. If you know that about yourself, why not fight it? Why not develop your character? Their answer has always been, because it's much easier not to. This reply leaves me feeling rather discouraged. Easy? Does that mean a life of deceit and laziness is easy too? Oh no, that can't be true. It can't be true that people are so readily tempted by ease and money. I've given a lot of thought to what my answer should be, to how I should get Peter to believe in himself and, most of all, to change himself for the better. I don't know whether I'm on the right track. I've often imagined how nice it would be if someone were to confide everything to me. But now that it's reached that point, I realize how difficult it is to put yourself in someone else's shoes and find the right answer, especially since easy and money are new and completely alien concepts to me. Peter's beginning to lean on me, and I don't want that, not under any circumstances. It's hard enough standing on your own 2 feet, but when you also have to remain true to your character and soul, it's harder still. I've been drifting around at sea, have spent days searching for an effective antidote to that terrible word, easy. How can I make it clear to him that, while it may seem easy and wonderful, it will drag him down to the depths, to a place where he'll no longer find friends, support, or beauty, so far down that he may never rise to the surface again? We're all alive, but we don't know why or what for. We're all searching for happiness. We're all leading lives that are different and yet the same. We three have been raised in good families. We have the opportunity to get an education and make something of ourselves. We have many reasons to hope for great happiness, but we have to earn it. And that's something you can't achieve by taking the easy way out. Earning happiness means doing good and working, not speculating and being lazy. Laziness may look inviting, but only work gives you true satisfaction. I can't understand people who don't like to work, but that isn't Peter's problem either. He just doesn't have a goal. Plus, he thinks he's too stupid and inferior to ever achieve anything. Poor boy. He's never known how it feels to make someone else happy, and I'm afraid I can't teach him. He isn't religious, scoffs at Jesus Christ, and takes the Lord's name in vain, and though I'm not Orthodox either, it hurts me every time to see him so lonely, so scornful, so wretched. People who are religious should be glad, since not everyone is blessed with the ability to believe in a higher order. You don't even have to live in fear of eternal punishment. The concepts of purgatory, heaven, and hell are difficult for many people to accept, yet religion itself, any religion, keeps a person on the right path. Not the fear of God, but upholding your own sense of honor and obeying your own conscience. How noble and good everyone could be if, at the end of each day, they were to review their own behavior and weigh up the rights and wrongs. They would automatically try to do better at the start of each new day, and, after a while, would certainly accomplish a great deal. Everyone is welcome to this prescription. It costs nothing and is definitely useful. Those who don't know will have to find out by experience that a quiet conscience gives you strength. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, July 8th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Brox was in Beverwijk and managed to get hold of strawberries at the produce auction. They arrived here dusty and full of sand, but in large quantities. No less than 24 crates for the office and us. That very same evening we canned the first 6 jars and made 8 jars of jam. The next morning Meep started making jam for the office. At 12:30 the outside door was locked, crates were lugged into the kitchen, with Peter, Father, and Mr. Van Dan stumbling up the stairs. Anne got hot water from the water heater, Margot went for a bucket, all hands on deck. With a funny feeling in my stomach, I entered the overcrowded office kitchen. Meep, Bep, Mr. Kleiman, Jan, Father, Peter, the Annex contingent, and the Supply Corps all mixed up together, and that in the middle of the day. Curtains and windows open, loud voices, banging doors. I was trembling with excitement. I kept thinking, are we really in hiding? This must be how it feels when you can finally go out into the world again. The pan was full, so I dashed upstairs where the rest of the family was hulling strawberries around the kitchen table. At least that's what they were supposed to be doing, but more was going into their mouths than in the buckets. They were bound to need another bucket soon. Peter went back downstairs, but then the doorbell rang twice. Leaving the bucket where it was, Peter raced upstairs and shut the bookcase behind him. We sat kicking our heels impatiently. The strawberries were waiting to be rinsed, but we stuck to the house rule. No running water when strangers are downstairs. They might hear the drains. Jan came up at once to tell us it had been the mailman. Peter hurried downstairs again. Ding dong, the doorbell, about face. I listened to hear if anyone was coming, standing first at the bookcase, then at the top of the stairs. Finally, Peter and I leaned over the banister, straining our ears like a couple of burglars to hear the sounds from downstairs. No unfamiliar voices. Peter tiptoed halfway down the stairs and called out, Bep! Once more, Bep! His voice was drowned out by the racket in the kitchen, so he ran down to the kitchen while I nervously kept watch from above. Go upstairs at once, Peter. The accountant's here. You've got to leave. It was Mr. Kugler's voice. Sighing, Peter came upstairs and closed the bookcase. Mr. Kugler finally came up at 1:30. My gosh, the whole world's turned to strawberries. I had strawberries for breakfast, Jan's having them for lunch, Kleiman's eating them as a snack, Meep's boiling them, Bep's hulling them, and I can smell them everywhere I go. I come upstairs to get away from all that red, and what do I see? People washing strawberries. The rest of the strawberries were canned. That evening, two jars came unsealed. Father quickly turned them into jam. The next morning, two more lids popped up, and that afternoon, four lids. Mr. Van Dan hadn't gotten the jars hot enough when he was sterilizing them, so Father ended up making jam every evening. We ate hot cereal with strawberries, buttermilk with strawberries, bread with strawberries, strawberries for dessert, strawberries with sugar, strawberries with sand. For 2 days, there was nothing but strawberries, 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 and then our supply was either exhausted or in jars, safely under lock and key. "Hey, Anne," Margot called out one day. "Mrs. Van Hoven has let us have some peas, 20 pounds. "That's nice of her," I replied, and it certainly was. "But it's so much work. Ugh." "On Saturday, you've all got to shell peas," Mother announced at the table. And sure enough, this morning after breakfast, our biggest enamel pan appeared on the table, filled to the brim with peas. "If you think shelling peas is boring work, you ought to try removing the inner linings. I don't think many people realize that once you've pulled out the linings, the pods are soft, delicious, and rich in vitamins. But an even greater advantage is that you get nearly 3 times as much as when you eat just the peas. Stripping pods is a precise and meticulous job that might be suited to pedantic dentists or finicky spice experts, but it's a horror for an impatient teenager like me. We started work at 9:30, I sat down at 10:30, got up again at 11, sat down again at 11:30. My ears were humming with the following refrain. Snap the end, strip the pod, pull the string, pod in the pan. Snap the end, strip the pod, pull the string, pod in the pan, etc., etc. My eyes were swimming. Green, green, worm, string, rotten pod, green, green. To fight the boredom and have something to do, I chattered all morning, saying whatever came into my head and making everyone laugh. The monotony was killing me. Every string I pulled made me more certain that I never, ever want to be just a housewife. At 12, we finally ate breakfast, but from 12:30 to 1:15, we had to strip pods again. When I stopped, I felt a bit seasick, and so did the others. I napped until 4, still in a daze because of those wretched peas. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, July 15th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, we've received a book from the library with the challenging title, What Do You Think of the Modern Young Girl? I'd like to discuss this subject today. The writer criticizes today's youth from head to toe, though without dismissing them all as hopeless cases. On the contrary, she believes they have it within their power to build a bigger, better, and more beautiful world, but that they occupy themselves with superficial things, without giving a thought to true beauty. In some passages, I had the strong feeling that the writer was directing her disapproval at me, which is why I finally want to bare my soul to you and defend myself against this attack. I have one outstanding character trait that must be obvious to anyone who's known me for any length of time. I have a great deal of self-knowledge. In everything I do, I can watch myself as if I were a stranger. I can stand across from the everyday Anne and, without being biased or making excuses, watch what she's doing, both the good and the bad. This self-awareness never leaves me, and every time I open my mouth, I think, you should have said that differently, or, that's fine the way it is. I condemn myself in so many ways that I'm beginning to realize the truth of Father's adage, every child has to raise itself. Parents can only advise their children or point them in the right direction. Ultimately, people shape their own characters. In addition, I face life with an extraordinary amount of courage. I feel so strong and capable of bearing burdens, so young and free. When I first realized this, I was glad because it means I can more easily withstand the blows life has in store. But I've talked about these things so often. Now I'd like to turn to the chapter, Father and Mother Don't Understand Me. My parents have always spoiled me rotten, treated me kindly, defended me against the Van Dans, and done all that parents can. And yet, for the longest time, I felt extremely lonely, left out, neglected, and misunderstood. Father did everything he could to curb my rebellious spirit, but it was no use. I've cured myself by holding my behavior up to the light and looking at what I was doing wrong. Why didn't Father support me in my struggle? Why did he fall short when he tried to offer me a helping hand? The answer is, he used the wrong methods. He always talked to me as if I were a child going through a difficult phase. It sounds crazy, since Father's the only one who's given me a sense of confidence and made me feel as if I'm a sensible person. But he overlooked one thing. He failed to see that this struggle to triumph over my difficulties was more important to me than anything else. I didn't want to hear about typical adolescent problems, or other girls, or you'll grow out of it. I didn't want to be treated the same as all the other girls, but as Anne in her own right, and Pim didn't understand that. Besides, I can't confide in anyone unless they tell me a lot about themselves, and because I know very little about him, I can't get on a more intimate footing. Pim always acts like the elderly father who once had the same fleeting impulses, but who can no longer relate to me as a friend, no matter how hard he tries. As a result, I've never shared my outlook on life or my long-pondered theories with anyone but my diary and, once in a while, Margot. I've hid anything having to do with me from Father, never shared my ideals with him, deliberately alienated myself from him. I couldn't have done it any other way. I've let myself be guided entirely by my feelings. It was egotistical, but I've done what was best for my own peace of mind. I would lose that, plus the self-confidence I've worked so hard to achieve, if I were to be subjected to criticism halfway through the job. It may sound hard-hearted, but I can't take criticism from Pim either, because not only do I never share my innermost thoughts with him, but I've pushed him even further away by being irritable. This is a point I think about quite often. Why is it that Pim annoys me so much sometimes? I can hardly bear to have him tutor me, and his affection seems forced. I want to be left alone, and I'd rather he ignored me for a while until I'm more sure of myself when I'm talking to him. I'm still torn with guilt about the mean letter I wrote him when I was so upset. Oh, it's hard to be strong and brave in every way. Still, this hasn't been my greatest disappointment. No, I think about Peter much more than I do Father. I know very well that he was my conquest, and not the other way around. I created an image of him in my mind, pictured him as a quiet, sweet, sensitive boy badly in need of friendship and love. I needed to pour out my heart to a living person. I wanted a friend who would help me find my way again. I accomplished what I set out to do and drew him, slowly but surely, toward me. When I finally got him to be my friend, it automatically developed into an intimacy that, when I think about it now, seems outrageous. We talked about the most private things, but we haven't yet touched upon the things closest to my heart. I still can't make head or tail of Peter. Is he superficial, or is it shyness that holds him back, even with me? But putting all that aside, I made one mistake. I used intimacy to get closer to him, and in doing so, I ruled out other forms of friendship. He longs to be loved, and I can see he's beginning to like me more with each passing day. Our time together leaves him feeling satisfied, but just makes me want to start all over again. I never broach the subjects I long to bring out into the open. I forced Peter, more than he realizes, to get close to me, and now he's holding on for dear life. I honestly don't see any effective way of shaking him off and getting him back on his own two feet. I soon realized he could never be a kindred spirit, but still tried to help him break out of his narrow world and expand his youthful horizons. Deep down, the young are lonelier than the old. I read this in a book somewhere, and it's stuck in my mind. As far as I can tell, it's true. So, if you're wondering whether it's harder for the adults here than for the children, the answer is no, it's certainly not. Older people have an opinion about everything and are sure of themselves and their actions. It's twice as hard for us young people to hold on to our opinions at a time when ideals are being shattered and destroyed, when the worst side of human nature predominates, when everyone has come to doubt truth, justice, and God. Anyone who claims that the older folks have a more difficult time in the annex doesn't realize that the problems have a far greater impact on us. We're much too young to deal with these problems, but they keep thrusting themselves on us until, finally, we're forced to think up a solution, though most of the time our solutions crumble when faced with the facts. It's difficult in times like these. Ideals, dreams, and cherished hopes rise within us, only to be crushed by grim reality. It's a wonder I haven't abandoned all my ideals. They seem so absurd and impractical. Yet, I cling to them because I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart. It's utterly impossible for me to build my life on a foundation of chaos, suffering, and death. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that, one day, will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions. And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better. That this cruelty too will end. That peace and tranquility will return once more. In the meantime, I must hold on to my ideals. Perhaps the day will come when I'll be able to realize them. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, July 21st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I'm finally getting optimistic. Now, at last, things are going well. They really are. Great news! An assassination attempt has been made on Hitler's life, and for once not by Jewish communists or English capitalists, but by a German general who's not only a count, but young as well. The Führer owes his life to divine providence. He escaped, unfortunately, with only a few minor burns and scratches. A number of the officers and generals who were nearby were killed or wounded. The head of the conspiracy has been shot. This is the best proof we've had so far that many officers and generals are fed up with the war and would like to see Hitler sink into a bottomless pit so they can establish a military dictatorship, make peace with the Allies, rearm themselves, and, after a few decades, start a new war. Perhaps Providence is deliberately biding its time getting rid of Hitler, since it's much easier and cheaper for the Allies to let the impeccable Germans kill each other off. It's less work for the Russians and the British, and it allows them to start rebuilding their own cities all that much sooner. But we haven't reached that point yet, and I'd hate to anticipate the glorious event. Still, you've probably noticed that I'm telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. For once, I'm not rattling on about high ideals. Furthermore, Hitler has been so kind as to announce to his loyal, devoted people that as of today, all military personnel are under orders of the Gestapo, and that any soldier who knows that one of his superiors was involved in this cowardly attempt on the Führer's life may shoot him on sight. A fine kettle of fish that will be. Little Johnny's feet are sore after a long march and his commanding officer bawls him out. Johnny grabs his rifle, shouts, You tried to kill the Führer! Take that! One shot and the snooty officer who dared to reprimand him passes into eternal life. Or is it eternal death? Eventually, every time an officer sees a soldier or gives an order, he'll be practically wetting his pants because the soldiers have more say-so than he does. Were you able to follow that? Or have I been skipping from one subject to another again? I can't help it. The prospect of going back to school in October is making me too happy to be logical. Oh, dear, didn't I just get through telling you I didn't want to anticipate events? Forgive me, Kitty. They don't call me a bundle of contradictions for nothing. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, August 1st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, a bundle of contradictions was the end of my previous letter and is the beginning of this one. Can you please tell me exactly what a bundle of contradictions is? What does contradiction mean? Like so many words, it can be interpreted in two ways. A contradiction imposed from without, and one imposed from within. The former means not accepting other people's opinions, always knowing best, having the last word. In short, all those unpleasant traits for which I'm known. The latter, for which I'm not known, is my own secret. As I've told you many times, I'm split in two. One side contains my exuberant cheerfulness, my flippancy, my joy in life, and above all, my ability to appreciate the lighter side of things. By that I mean not finding anything wrong with flirtations, a kiss, an embrace, an off-color joke. This side of me is usually lying in wait to ambush the other one, which is much purer, deeper, and finer. No one knows Anne's better side, and that's why most people can't stand me. Oh, I can be an amusing clown for an afternoon, but after that everyone's had enough of me to last a month. Actually, I'm what a romantic movie is to a profound thinker. A mere diversion. A comic interlude. Something that is soon forgotten. Not bad, but not particularly good either. I hate having to tell you this, but why shouldn't I admit it when I know it's true? My lighter, more superficial side will always steal a march on the deeper side, and therefore always win. You can imagine how often I've tried to push away this Anne, which is only half of what is known as Anne, to beat her down, hide her, but it doesn't work, and I know why. I'm afraid that people who know me as I usually am will discover I have another side, a better and finer side. I'm afraid they'll mock me, think I'm ridiculous and sentimental and not take me seriously. I'm used to not being taken seriously, but only the light-hearted Anne is used to it and can put up with it. The deeper Anne is too weak. If I force the good Anne into the spotlight for even 15 minutes, she shuts up like a clam the moment she's called upon to speak and lets Anne number one do the talking. Before I realize it, she's disappeared. So the nice Anne is never seen in company. She's never made a single appearance, though she almost always takes the stage when I'm alone. I know exactly how I'd like to be, how I am, on the inside. But unfortunately, I'm only like that with myself. And perhaps that's why. No, I'm sure that's the reason why. I think of myself as happy on the inside, and other people think I'm happy on the outside. I'm guided by the pure Anne within, but on the outside, I'm nothing but a frolicsome little goat tugging at its tether. As I've told you, what I say is not what I feel, which is why I have a reputation for being boy crazy as well as a flirt, a smart aleck, and a reader of romances. The happy-go-lucky Anne laughs, gives a flippant reply, shrugs her shoulders, and pretends she doesn't give a darn. The quiet Anne reacts in just the opposite way. If I'm being completely honest, I'll have to admit that it does matter to me, that I'm trying very hard to change myself, but that I'm always up against a more powerful enemy. A voice within me is sobbing, "You see, that's what's become of you. You're surrounded by negative opinions, dismayed looks, and mocking faces. People who dislike you, and all because you don't listen to the advice of your own better half." Believe me, I'd like to listen, but it doesn't work, because if I'm quiet and serious, everyone thinks I'm putting on a new act and I have to save myself with a joke. And then I'm not even talking about my own family, who assume I must be sick, stuff me with aspirins and sedatives, feel my neck and forehead to see if I have a temperature, ask about my bowel movements, and berate me for being in a bad mood, until I just can't keep it up anymore. Because when everybody starts hovering over me, I get cross, then sad, and finally end up turning my heart inside out. The bad part on the outside, the good part on the inside. And keep trying to find a way to become what I'd like to be and what I could be if only there were no other people in the world. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Anne's diary ends here. Afterward. On the morning of August 4th, 1944, sometime between 10 and 10:30, a car pulled up at 263 Prinzengracht. Several figures emerged, an SS sergeant, Karl Josef Silberbauer, in full uniform, and at least three Dutch members of the security police, armed but in civilian clothes. Someone must have tipped them off. They arrested the eight people hiding in the annex, as well as two of their helpers, Victor Kugler and Johannes Kleiman, though not Miep Gies and Elizabeth Bepp Foskel, and took all the valuables and cash they could find in the annex. After the arrest, Kugler and Kleiman were taken to a prison in Amsterdam. On September 11, 1944, they were transferred, without benefit of a trial, to a camp in Amersfoort, Holland. Kleiman, because of his poor health, was released on September 18, 1944. He remained in Amsterdam until his death in 1959. Kugler managed to escape his imprisonment on March 28, 1945, when he and his fellow prisoners were being sent to Germany as forced laborers. He immigrated to Canada in 1955 and died in Toronto in 1989. Elizabeth Bepp Foskel Vick died in Amsterdam in 1983. Miep Santrouchets Gies died in Amsterdam January 11, 2010. Her husband Jan died in 1993. Upon their arrest, the eight residents of the annex were first brought to a prison in Amsterdam and then transferred to Westerbork, the transit camp for Jews in the north of Holland. They were deported on September 3, 1944, in the last transport to leave Westerbork, and arrived 3 days later in Auschwitz, Poland. Herman Van Pels, Van Dan, was, according to the testimony of Otto Frank, gassed to death in Auschwitz in October or November 1944, shortly before the gas chambers were dismantled. August Van Pels, Petronella Van Dan, was transferred from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen, from there to Buchenwald, then to Theresienstadt, on April 9, 1945, and apparently to another concentration camp after that. It is certain that she did not survive, though the date of her death is unknown. Peter Van Pels, Van Dan, was forced to take part in the January 16, 1945 Death March from Auschwitz to Mauthausen, Austria, where he died on May 5, 1945, 3 days before the camp was liberated. Fritz Pfeffer, Albert Dussel, died on December 20, 1944, in the Neuengamme concentration camp, where he had been transferred from either Buchenwald or Sachsenhausen. Edith Frank died in Auschwitz-Birkenau on January 6, 1945, from hunger and exhaustion. Margot and Anne Frank were transported from Auschwitz at the end of October and brought to Bergen-Belsen, a concentration camp near Hanover, Germany. The typhus epidemic that broke out in the winter of 1944 to 1945, as a result of the horrendous hygienic conditions, killed thousands of prisoners, including Margot and, a few days later, Anne. She must have died in late February or early March. The bodies of both girls were probably dumped in Bergen-Belsen's mass graves. The camp was liberated by British troops on April 12, 1945. Otto Frank was the only one of the eight to survive the concentration camps. After Auschwitz was liberated by Russian troops, he was repatriated to Amsterdam by way of Odessa and Marseille. He arrived in Amsterdam on June 3, 1945, and stayed there until 1953, when he moved to Basel, Switzerland, where his sister and her family, and later his brother, lived. He married Elfriede Markowitz Geiringer, originally from Vienna, who had survived Auschwitz and lost a husband and son in Mauthausen. Until his death on August 19, 1980, Otto Frank continued to live in Bersfelden, outside Basel, where he devoted himself to sharing the message of his daughter's diary with people all over the world. This is Selma Blair. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank, edited by Otto H. Frank and Miriam Pressler, and translated by Susan Masati. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and Dan Zitt and directed by David Rapkin. Text copyright 1991 by the Anne Frank Fonds. English copyright 1995 by Doubleday, a division of Random House, Inc. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.